Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a journalist and a reporter and advocate for health, food, and the environment. I report on the Huffington Post and on Alternet and on my own website, healthjournalistblog.com. Every week on this show, I talk to different folks and different experts and people with experience and know-how in connecting the dots between our personal health and our total health environment. I spent a decade or more as a health reporter telling people how to lead a healthy life and take care of themselves, and it's advice I still value, offer, and follow. But at the same time, we're not going to achieve health unless we take a bigger look at the health of our total environment. That means the health of our food, water, air, the health of our communities, the health of our society, and, of course, the health of planet Earth, our habitat, and the support for all life. So every week on Connect the Dots, this is what we do, talking to a whole range of different folks. I begin every show with activism, and today's opportunities to participate connect with our show's theme. We're going to be talking about the Occupy Sandy relief efforts that have been going on in New York with a special guest who's been present and involved and engaged from the very beginning. This will help people see really kind of what the kind of price we pay and societies and communities pay and many, many individuals pay when we fail to take a preventive, proactive approach to health and really assure that our habitat and our communities are safe. If we place other economic or political priorities above health and the environment, we pay a very steep price, both economically and personally. And so we'll be talking about that on today's show with our guests very shortly. I begin every program with a couple of action opportunities because I want to encourage all my listeners to take action, whether you do it many times a day or whether you do it, when you hear my show. At least it'll get you started. And I think more and more people, when I began doing this, I think people were like, activism? What? We want health. We want journalism to be objective. But it's hard to be objective, really, completely objective. We can be objective to a certain degree, of course, in terms of presenting facts and documenting them and differentiating facts from opinion. But we can't really be objective about passionate concerns like protecting future generations and life on Earth, and that's why I urge activism every week. There are things that you can do if you are in the New York region, Northeast area. I'm going to tell you about a couple of very special events that are really exciting happening today and tomorrow. And you can also participate nationally by supporting Occupy Sandy Relief and other organizations. We'll be talking about that more in the program as well. But today I want to give a shout out to two special events, two films that we'll be showing. Josh Fox, the director of Gasland, has produced a film about relief efforts in New York, and it will benefit the Occupy Sandy movement. His new short film called Occupy Sandy, A Human Response to the New Realities of Climate Change, will show the damage left behind by the storm, highlighting the heroic grassroots efforts of Occupy activists and drawing the connection between storm, climate change, and the greed of the fossil fuel industry. So there's going to be a special event tonight in New York City. You can find out about the location, which will be announced today, may have already been announced, we'll see, by texting, and text messaging does apply, to at Climate Crime, number 23559, or you can follow the hashtag Climate Crime on Twitter for information about that exciting gathering. In addition, there's also other information about that, which I'll continue to share with you throughout the program. In addition, there's going to be an event tomorrow if you're in the New York or Northeast region, the premiere of a film called Dear Governor Cuomo. This film will be shown and premiering at the New York Ethical Culture Society tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. This is at 2 West 64th Street. You should come at 6 in order to get a seat. There are a number of artists featured in the film, including musician Natalie Merchant, actor Mark Ruffalo, singer Joan Osborne, Melissa Leo, a whole bunch of others, Toshi Regan of Sweet Honey and the Rock. So that's going to be a terrific event. You can come to that also. And follow me on Facebook at Allison Rose Levy, or Connecting the Dots for Health is my page, where I also share these kinds of events and information. So now I want to bring on our guest for this morning, who is an activist I very much admire. She's Jessica Roth, a former federal Indian law practitioner, a climate justice and anti-fracking and food justice activist, and she's been... hi, Jessica. Welcome.
Hello, Allison.
Hi. You've been serving as a full-time volunteer, core Occupy Sandy organizer in the Rockaways of New York since right after the storm. I know this personally because I had trouble getting her on the phone because actually power and cell phone lines and everything else were down in the area where she was serving. So it made it really hard to serve, to organize, and do all the rest of it. But now she's temporarily back in the indoors in the dry and near a phone, so she can share with us about all of the various issues that and the experiences, you know, that she's what it's like to, you know, to be there, to be on the ground, to be of service. I just want to say before asking you the first question, I've just been so impressed with the outreach of the New York community. You know, there's kind of a fiction that New Yorkers are, sort of cold or self-involved or very ambitious. And here are, you know, literally hundreds of people, thousands of people who've donated, hundreds of people who've gone on site, you know, making it a priority to go as often as they possibly can, week, day after day, week after week. Some may go by a couple of days a week. Some have basically camped out there in an amazing demonstration of selfless service and community spirit and caring that I just think has been so impressive, and you've been part of that and in the midst of that. Tell our listeners, tell me a little bit about that. How did you get involved?
Well, honestly, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do to get involved to help out after the storm, and I think the first thing I did once I got back to my own home where I had power, because I've been staying with my mom who lost power and water, was to get on Facebook and see what was going on. And a couple of my friends had already liked the Occupy Sandy relief page. And so I originally had planned to go down and cook at the site in Red Hook because I'm also a food person. And that's sort of my answer to most things, to feed people. And that was, of course, before we knew how, you know, devastated everything was. And I went to the first site, and then a message came out that they were full for people volunteering for cooking, and we should go to St. Jacoby instead. So I went there, and there was already too many people cooking, so I did a couple of pickups of donated equipment and resources. And then the next day I came back to cook again and said, you know, I'm here to cook, but I also have a car. And Diego, who is one of the many amazing core organizers from Occupy, who was there at the time, happened to be standing by the door when I walked in and said, you have a car, do you want to go to the Rockaways? And I said, sure. And that was the beginning of what has become a nearly four-week endeavor here with, as you were saying, like just an amazing group of people. I can't say enough about the organizers from outside the community, the organizers from inside the community, the people who have come out in every way, shape, and form from every corner. I mean, we've had people drive in from Oregon and Florida and Maine and everywhere in between. And then the group of the core organizers that are mostly not from here, but some with various degrees of connection to the Rockaways. And then there's a ton of community organizations and church organizations we're working with, and community members who lost everything and walked into one of our distribution sites to get a flashlight or to plug in their cell phone or to do something, and then came back day after day after day. And the family that we've built out here is just one of the most impressive groups of people I've ever had the privilege to be a part of.
Wow, that's incredible. And, you know, how many people are out there, I mean, would you say? I mean, before we go to that, one of the questions I think that's been in a lot of people's minds are, you know, if you look at the entire calamity, the crisis on a national level, I think, you know, some people have said, well, you know, we shouldn't have a federal government, we shouldn't have federal disaster relief, we shouldn't, you know, the federal, there's no role for the federal government, the states should do everything, and yet the states, you know, also lack any infrastructure for addressing this. So on the national level, in the first days of the storm, what happened was that, you know, the word was support the Red Cross, hooray for FEMA, and, you know, we're not trying to knock them. They have done a job, but they're called to many different locales as this storm hit such a wide scope of different places, different states, different areas. And what's emerged is not that we should always rely on our neighbors to kind of come forth and deal with disaster, but that without extensive pre-existing infrastructures in place, the national organizations can and must do some basic things. But surprisingly, the Occupy movement reconfigured as they flexibly can as Occupy Sandy Relief, you know, has emerged as basically being the most connected and rooted at the grassroots ground level. And I think that was a big surprise to many people that happened. Care to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, there's a lot of reasons why Occupy was able to step in and fill in the void. I think also what you were saying before about infrastructure and on the ground and, you know, relief organizations has proven throughout this experience at least to not be the case. I mean, I don't know the details of what the infrastructure actually is, but I do know that being on the ground, it's not working. None of the major organizations have been effective, be they governmental or non-governmental. I mean, in the very beginning, except for the Department of Sanitation, and surprisingly to many of the people, I think, on both sides of the coin, NYPD and IOWS, reincarnated as Occupy Sandy, have been getting along swimmingly out here and work together very closely. I have personally deployed a number of police cars to locations that we've needed help. But in general, I mean, I think that whatever the red tape is, be it non-governmental organization, be it governmental organization, be it, you know, relief, you know, allegedly, or be it volunteer organizations, it's detrimental. It bogs things down, and there's so much that can't be done. And like you were saying about sort of the, you know, deployment to a national scope of problem, on the flip side, most of these organizations have deployed people from around the country to here as well. So you have, you know, FEMA representatives from Missouri and, you know, no offense to them, but little white-haired ladies from the Red Cross who are 65 years old coming in from, you know, Indiana or wherever they are. And, like, those are not women who can walk up 12 flights of stairs in high-rises where the power is out to effectively canvas the needs of the people. Mm-hmm. So it's been a really, really big problem. I understand that there's safety issues and there's liability issues and that those are kinds of things that also bog down organizations. But, you know, from our experience on the ground, it was at least 3 days before Red Cross appeared, and then they never left the safety of the police precinct. You know, they were parked in front of the police precinct. They wouldn't go into the poorer neighborhoods. They weren't really, you know, paying attention. They weren't getting out of the trucks to help. You know, their different missions don't know what their other missions are doing, so it's very complicated to liaise with them. Mm-hmm. The federal government, you know, I mean, the thing I've learned, I think, more than anything else in this context is there actually is no emergency relief response structure in this country. FEMA is not an emergency relief organization. It's the emergency management. Those are two different things. And they're about property, and they're about, you know, giving resources back to people who have lost property if and when they deem it to be the case that they're eligible for it. Mm-hmm. And we've seen time and time again, anecdotally on the ground here, people who have gotten nothing or a lot for, like, the same situation. So there's loads of people who have applied to FEMA and are being flat out rejected, and we can't figure out why. Mm. And that's a huge problem. But FEMA is not an emergency response team. Like, I personally, I've talked about this with friends on FDNY, with friends in Occupy. I don't know what happens between, like, the 911 call to the fire department or the police department, mm-hmm. and 5 days later when somebody bothers to show up on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where that hole is really supposed to be filled, because it certainly mm-hmm. seems clear that not mm-hmm. enough lessons were learned from Katrina, not mm-hmm. enough infrastructure was built up, not enough response that's appropriate was put into place. I mean, we were the only ones on the ground. We were here before FEMA, Red Cross, National Guard. The only other people here when we got here were sanitation, FDNY, and NYPD.
Okay, let's just say sanitation, FDN. So you're saying the New York Fire Department, the New York Sanitation Department, because some of these acronyms are not familiar
to the national audience here. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that was it. You know, mm-hmm. National Guard rolled in a few days later. Mm-hmm. As I understand it, you know, Mayor Bloomberg said we didn't need the help of the National Guard, which was completely absurd. And so there was very little going on the ground. And within the first few days, we created, distribution centers. We were getting hot food prepared and sent out here. So we were feeding people hot meals. We were giving out everything from blankets to clothing to flashlights to canned goods to cleaning supplies. Pampers, like kids' baby supplies, was a huge issue. We set up, we started out at one site and we just kept expanding from, we started out at YANA, which is an organization that stands for You Are Never Alone, which just was a serendipitous meeting between Diego, one of the first organizers on the ground, and Sal Lopizo, who's the founder of YANA, and mm-hmm. he had seen his place destroyed. It was supposed to be a career training center, and then when we showed up, he was like, wow, this must be what I'm supposed to be doing, mm-hmm. and that became sort of our heart and soul of our movement out here, and then mm-hmm. we just expanded, on down the numbers all the way down the peninsula and set up distribution sites and set up canvassing and set up, situations where people were bringing supplies up for homebound people. We set up our own medical clinics. I mean, we literally went to a FEMA table. There was like a series of different, there was like lawyers and FEMA set up at this location, and they were handing out flyers sending people to our medical clinic.
Mhm. Mhm.
You can't make it up. Like, the madness
that's incredible
going on. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. completely insane. And yeah,
now I have a question about mm-hmm. that. Which is, you have doctors there and nurses. People are, coming there and volunteering day after day. I mean, like when you say, I'm just focusing on one thing because of, mm-hmm. my own interest in health and all of that, and that is the theme of our program here. I mean, just to man a clinic, no one's paying for these people to come. Maybe they can't come every day of the week. That's a huge undertaking, right there. I mean, what, just give us a snapshot. Maybe that's not your area of specific knowledge, but, I mean, how do you keep this manned or know who's coming, or is it just a kind of show up and it all works out kind of thing? I mean, how
it's a
much?
A little bit of both.
Okay,
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So basically, one of our organizers had, her parents are doctors, so she has connections in the medical world, and she's sort of grown mm-hmm. up in that world.
Mm-hmm.
Nasrin Mohit, and she put out the word, and mm-hmm. A lot of the hospitals were closed down because of the storm, mm-hmm. and so people are actually don't have jobs right now, and just mm-hmm. the doctors and nurses and nurse practitioners and physicians mm-hmm. assistants and pharmacists started mm-hmm. coming out of the woodwork,
mm-hmm.
and so the first week, obviously, everything was a lot more sort of daily, that's not right. Everything was a lot more continual in the first week because sort of the city had shut down. And so there was a lot of the same people were coming day after day. And then things changed a little bit. But a lot of these doctors still don't have, their places of employment aren't back in full operation. So we've had a lot of continuity. We don't necessarily have all the same people each day, but we have, we've put together a system of our own of files. And, we have people who can get out meds to people. We have had lots and lots of donations of over-the-counter things and first aid equipment. We have street medics who are involved in OWS, and people are just, we just put together an ad hoc medical clinic, essentially. Now,
amazing.
More and more of the clinics on the ground and the hospital are open, and So we're trying to also transition people into some of those situations, but it kind of goes to the bigger picture, which is the fact that the Rockaways were in a really bad position before this storm, and most people, you know, maybe know about, you know, the boardwalk and the beach and surfing and some food in the summer, but what most people don't know about the Rockaways is that it's actually predominantly inner city, it's predominantly minority, there's major issues of economic inequalities, huge unemployment, massive problems with housing, tons of public housing, NYCHA, Mitchell Llama projects, and a really underserved, disenfranchised community out here. And all of those things are exacerbated by the storm. But so, you know, people are, there's a lot of advocacy of trying to, or people, sort of the bigger picture, people are trying to get, you know, the community members back to clinics and things like that. But it's not necessarily the right answer. Or we're not sure what the right answer is, honestly, because a lot of those clinics weren't serving the needs of the people that well before the storm either. So it's, there's a lot of issues, a lot that has to get addressed in moving forward in a way that's going to be productive and sustainable for the community.
Wow, that's incredible. You know, the people who are there week after week, month after month, how are people able, I guess you're into the first month here, but how are people able to actually do this? I mean, this is so, you know, do they come in different shifts, taking time off from other work? Is it part of the whole economic picture that there's a spontaneously self-created a task force of relief workers from those who, are working partially or not at all in these economic hard times? I mean, do we need in an ongoing way, is this a kind of almost like, do we need a relief corps in the days where we used to have a peace corps, for example? Is this an opportunity to really, you know, how can this be made sustainable? Is this spontaneous act of service, how can it continue and how can it be made sustainable? I mean, are there conversations about this? Is this something people are considering? You know, what are your thoughts about it?
We haven't had a bigger picture conversation about that, but the relief corps is a brilliant idea, frankly. A domestic relief corps would be extremely, I think, beneficial. The issue is that, of course, once you make a relief corps, then you get bogged down into whatever all of the red tape of that is going to be. And ostensibly the National Guard is supposed to be doing some of that, and they have done some of it. But what I can't figure out is sort of the level. I mean, they've done waves. They've been here for a couple of days on individual projects, and from conversations I've had with specific individual members of the Corps, it was my understanding that they have sort of different ways that they can provide, like that they can do, they have people who can do construction, they have people who can do demo, they have people who can do cleaning, they have people who can do medical, but we've only seen the medical sweep of them, which came through in a few days with the Department of Health. So they're not doing that, although I'm not really sure if that's, I don't know the overlap between what the real role of the National Guard is versus being like an actual relief corps, but I think that is something. I mean, on a day-to-day level out here, it's something we're struggling with. I mean, it's about to be the first of the month, and many of our organizers are either unemployed, underemployed, or freelancers and are now not freelancing to get the money that they would be getting if they were doing that. So, you know, it's a huge concern that we're going to start losing really critical people because we need to get them paid, honestly, and we need to get community members paid. I mean, obviously our top priority is getting community members reemployed. There's a ton of people who lost their jobs either because of, you know, business flooding, to, you know, other kinds of destruction. They have lost their homes, so they are displaced themselves, so they can't get to a job. They lost their car. I mean, there's so many reasons that people are unemployed out here. Not to mention, as I was saying before, of course, that lots and lots of them were unemployed before, and there was a huge job crisis out here to begin with. But in addition to that, there's a group of, I'd say about 20 or so core organizers out here, all of which have received little or no income from alternative sources than what we're doing day to day, but this has essentially become a full-time job for everybody. We have people who have quit their paying jobs because they just can't envision going back to doing that when this is what has to be happening day to day, and those are people who, you know, have to pay rent in 3 days, and it's definitely an enormous issue. It's something where we are trying desperately to make ourselves sustainable. And to that end, and your health focus of this, you know, we're working on self-maintenance and trying to take days off and not get sick and all that kind of stuff too, which is a huge problem, as you can, I'm sure, hear from my lovely, sexy voice right now. We all have this, like, rasp in our throats, from which is probably related to what everyone out here is calling the Rockaway cough. There's tons of particulate matter in the air. There's tons of sand. There's tons of mold. It's a, you know, there's definitely concerns for, I mean, that's like, you know, that's a whole other segue, but I mean, the public health crisis that's upon us here is enormous. The minor thing of that is that the people here have, you know, sore throats
and cough. Let's talk a little bit more about that. We have to take our station identification break here momentarily, but I think that's really important because what you're saying is there's, along with everything else, and this should come as no surprise, you know, when you don't take care of communities and you don't take care of the environment, you create health vectors. And health vectors can, you know, start one place and travel on from there. It's one thing people don't understand. They kind of think if they take their vitamin C and shut the door, it won't come to them. But we'll talk a little bit about the health impacts after this break. Stay with us, listeners, for the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, talking about Occupy Sandy Relief today with Jessica Roth. Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. This is the second half of our show. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network, connecting the dots between health and our total health environment. On today's show, we're talking about Occupy Sandy Relief, the aftermath of the terrible storm that happened just about a month ago, hitting the North Atlantic region with especially hard impacts in New York and ongoing crisis in communities. On this program, I regularly have reported on health, the environment, fracking, climate change, and please check out our archives where this program will also be, and you can pass it along to friends if you've enjoyed it. Check at Progressive Radio Network's archives under Connect the Dots, and you'll see other programs on climate change. We had somebody from 350.org on our last show. We are going to have upcoming guests from the Sierra Club, also talking about the new health impact assessment in New York State, and a whole host of really interesting things. Another program upcoming will be connecting attitudes and psychological predispositions about the environment to environmental activism and what we need to do to protect our environment, our communities, and our health. Let's go back to today's show with Jessica Roth. I also want to say that as you listen to this, and if you're concerned, if you would like to contribute, you can go to Occupy Sandy Relief online as well as on Facebook and make a financial contribution. You can volunteer. You can stay informed. And I want to say a special shout-out to some friends of mine from Facebook who pitched in and bought a generator. That was delivered to Occupy Sandy a week ago. But certainly there's always a list on the OccupySandyRelief.org website about their ongoing needs, just for simple things like flashlights and other things that you can send. So let's return to my guest today, Jessica Roth. So, Jessica, in the last half hour, we kind of ended talking a little bit about what you were calling the Rockaway's cough. And I was, you know, as you pointed out, although I don't hear it, you sound fine to me, but, you know, your voice is, I guess, a little bit hoarser than it has been. But, you know, back when, sadly, you know, when we had 911 11 years ago in the city, you know, I watched then as, you know, people came to help and contribute. That was obviously a highly, highly toxic situation with building materials. And, you know, the overarching federal government, the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, which at the time this was in the Bush administration, you know, was basically kind of really literally, it was later shown to, and I've to whitewash what was going on and claim that there was no risk to relief workers, those who valiantly showed up to dig for bodies and save lives in the first, digging through the rubble in the first days of the tragedy. And yet later, you know, first there was a kind of whitewash. Oh, this is perfectly healthy. Make sure to wear your mask, but we don't have enough of them. So if you don't, it's kind of your own responsibility. And then there was a lot of photographs of people standing in hard hats with, you know, our heroes, the firemen. But later when, you know, people fell ill and had health problems, it was a real, you know, fight. To get their health needs met, and it took a lot of muscle and power to even honor the commitments made to public workers who are, in that case, were paid to kind of jump to the fore. And I think that may also be some reason why, knowing the climate we're in, and I can't second guess them at all, but what you described earlier in the show with Red Cross workers, you know, kind of sitting safely in their truck, you know, the service workers that are hired may be reluctant to come to our support when we have a climate of, you know, kind of critiquing government and not wanting to pay for this and that and thinking we can do without it. And then we match that with climate change causing, you know, more weather and natural disasters that, you know, really decimate communities. So, you know, we're on a very unpleasant trajectory here, I believe. you know, if we don't both support the infrastructures, build new ones like the Relief Corps we talked about, and also deal with the causes of climate change and the, you know, addiction to fossil fuels, which are a major contributing factor to it. So I just want to kind of sort of highlight that a little bit because, you know, the fact is we can... you know, there are health risks involved, and this is both to the affected communities, to the relief workers, but also if you have, you know, a vicinity, a neighborhood that's, you know, affected in this way, one thing people don't realize, you know, they kind of, we try to kind of isolate ourselves from others and go, well, they have a problem, but I'm okay. You know, I'll take vitamins. My home is safe. I'll put in an air purifier or something else. You know, the things that affluent people think to do to protect their health. But the fact is that what we create or allow to happen or have to deal with due to storms like this in poor communities also travels. It doesn't just stay there. It's more intense there. It's more focused there. But the, you know, the mold spores, the disease vectors, they're carried by wind and air and water. They don't just stay in one place, and they do have broader impacts. So what you're also describing with winter coming on, and you can maybe resume that a little bit and talk a little bit more about it for those who are just tuning into our second half hour, is really, you know, a very concerning health disease vectors in the making in the affected communities. You know, are you guys thinking about that? I mean, what are some of the things, you know, because you have buildings soggy, moldy, you know, breaking down. I mean, that's problems. That's mold problems, and mold can be very persistent and can travel. Are you guys, I'm just concerned. Are you guys wearing face masks and stuff like this?
Depends on the day. Some days we're better about that than others. I mean, there's so much about what you just talked about. I mean, I think, first of all, that the parallel of 9/11 is actually really poignant and pressing, because the fact is that, you know, there, I know you said, you know, you were saying how it was particularly toxic because obviously two large buildings went down. But, you know, our first site over here is down the block from a place where about 10 different buildings burnt down. And we've been standing working in this area the whole time. So on top of, you know, what people already know as, you know, probably the sand that's blowing around and the mold that's around because of the wet, there were loads of fires out here and tons of buildings that were destroyed all the way down to their foundations. So we have a lot of the same things in the air that there were at 9/11, you know, and we're certainly concerned about those kinds of things. And protective gear, we have some of it. The respirators, like the hardcore respirators that, you know, with filters and everything that look like gas masks, those are really expensive. We don't have those on the ground here for the most part. We just have a few. But that's, you know, that's something we definitely need, and that's definitely something people can help with. We have, you know, different face masks. We wear some, people wear gear depending on the job that they're doing, but people walking around the street, kind of it depends on the day. And the issue about whitewashing, I think, is a big problem as well out here. You know, I just heard an interview on ABC on Monday with, I believe her name is Susan Clark from the Department of Health, who said when she was asked by the reporter about that volunteers were saying that there was a public health crisis, she said that they've been monitoring ERs and hospitals and haven't seen any upticks. So they don't think that there's a problem, essentially, which, of course, is, you know, would be sort of the ninth step on the spectrum of measuring a public health crisis. The issue here is that we have people who are homebound. We have elderly. We have children who have still no water, no electric, no phone service. They can't call 911 if they want to. They don't have a phone. They don't necessarily know that St. John's Hospital is back up again after the storm because it was closed for weeks because they don't have access to the news. There's loads of people who have no way to have access to any of the limited infrastructure that's out here. So monitoring things like ER visits is like sticking your head in the sand, frankly, because the issue is that people are trapped in cold, freezing, mold-ridden homes. It's an ongoing problem. We're all exposed to the mold, whether we're the relief workers or whether we're community members. Even the people who are just visiting here, those of us who live in other communities and are working here, we're here 12, 14, 16 hours a day, every single day. We have nearly as much exposure as community members, but that's not to say that, you know, the community members are obviously in a far worse position because they don't have anywhere else to go. Like, I go home at night and I sleep in a bed where I have heat and I take a hot shower in the morning, and I'm super conscious of that every night, and it makes me feel guilty and it makes me feel thankful and it makes me realize how horrifically imbalanced everything is that's going on here. There's been, you know, some comparisons to Katrina, and I think a lot of people think that that's overblown because the media has sort of moved on from this story and all the power's back in Manhattan and everybody thinks everything's really okay. But I tell you, you really can't understand how horrible situation is for people out here until you see it firsthand. I've never seen anything like it. I've traveled to like 14 countries and 43 states, and I've never seen anything like the devastation that's going on out here. We even were talking with people from the Rockaway Resilience, which is part of the Global Resilience Movement. I don't exactly know. They came out of the Global Health Initiative, and the guy from that organization was saying that he would rank Katrina on a scale of 3 of destruction, and this on a scale as a 5. Things are truly, truly devastated. We are trying to rebuild. And, you know, as you mentioned, that all of it is obviously connected to the climate and climate change and the fact that the temperature of the ocean was so much warmer that it made the storm so much worse. And, you know, people here are conscious of that and aware of that. We've been working on education and talking to communities and community members and community organizations about how the big picture all fits together. Greenpeace, who's been an amazing ally, showed up here literally the day after the storm and got connected with us, and they've been solar powering much of our operations. And so we've had these giant solar arrays and solar trucks around, and people are getting, you know, engaged and intrigued by what's going on with that. And, you know, we really want to be working. We need to be, you know, destroying a lot because of the mold. I mean, stuff has to come down, you know, walls have to come down. I'm concerned because there's businesses that are opening their doors, and I understand why, because they've lost tons of money and tons of resources. But any businesses that are open out here have obviously not done proper mold remediation and rebuilding, so that's a concern. There's people who are also living in those situations. There's people whose landlords are trying to patch things over quickly. There's people whose landlords are trying to get their properties condemned so that they can kick them out. I mean, there's a huge issue coming up that we're going to have to deal with of, you know, disaster capitalism and people trying to, you know, raise the Rockaways to, you know, pave paradise and put up a parking lot, but, you know, in the form of a casino and a...
Really?
And hotels. Oh, yeah, everyone. I mean, this is a huge concern. The word on the street is that that's the mayor's view, and that's his vision for the Rockaways, is to make it the Hamptons, to make it its next, you know... There's projects on prime real estate out here. Like, people are not happy about that. There's money to be made.
But where are they actually going to take the people? I mean, where are they going?
That's a question. We haven't answered the question of where we're going to take the people right now who are about to start dying in their homes and already are dying in their homes. But since, you know, the numbers aren't showing upticks in the emergency rooms in the hospitals, nobody's talking about it. Like, I know for a fact of 2 people that died in the Redfern project 2 days ago because they couldn't get their prescriptions filled. I mean, people are dying, like, no question about it, because of medicine, because of cold. It's going to be longer term because of mold. There's no plan as of now to evacuate people. That's like a real plan. From that same interview that I heard with the Department of Health person, they were talking about that there's no standard point at which the Department of Health is going to say, now it's a mandatory health evacuation and we have to get people out of these places. So, you know, we're all trying to figure out how to get people out of situations now where they're going to be dying and getting really sick really quickly. And again, these are the things that, you know, we can only do so much as the volunteer organizations on the ground, which are really the people who are being the most effective and doing the most work. I mean, like I mentioned, there's a lot of other community organizations, church groups, community activists, you know, up and down this peninsula, and we're all working together. But, you know, the mayor has the ability to, like, bring in the army and build these housing, it's called. I just forgot again. I think it's Red Horse. And they're like the mobile little villages that the military pops up when they land in a place that has no infrastructure. I mean, mm-hmm. We can be building. We can be bringing in things. But the mayor is blocking stuff from FEMA, and he's blocking actions. He's blocking warming tents. I mean, it's unbelievable what's happening on the ground out here. And so people are really in a dire way. I mean, it's really a public health crisis out here, regardless of what the emergency room numbers are saying. And it has to get addressed. And we are, you know, we're working with a group called Restore and Rebuild, and they have experience. They've been in Haiti and with Katrina, and, you know, we're assessing individual homes and pulling things down and rebuilding and doing mold remediation and all of that. But, you know, this was still based on a volunteer effort. Like, we, you know, if the mayor had the political will to do it, you know, I mean, like, if I were in charge, I would reallocate all the city employees for a weekend and get an effective canvas of this entire peninsula and figure out who are the people that need to get moved out and whose places need to be remediated and whose places need to get, you know, completely whatever, you know, cleaned out, whatever it is. And, mm-hmm. and I mean, there's mm-hmm. people. I mean, we live in a city of 8 million people. It's not like we can't get these things done, but, you know,
but it isn't being done because there's, you know, it's really people that have to, you know, put the pressure on these politicians because they, you know, there's so much money spent on these campaigns that they have are beholden to others and have other priorities. As yep. we're speaking here, I'm also getting a website where people can go to make donations. And as I did that, I saw that, and this is just yet another example. I mean, I brought down a whole bunch of produce that was donated by upstate mm-hmm. New York State farmers and to, you know, like all kinds of things. It really served as, it was basically the foods that would be cooked for a Thanksgiving meal, you know, all the Brussels right. sprouts and the wonderful things that grow in our agricultural state. And I brought boxes and boxes of these to the St. Jacoby Church in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, which now is, and this was, you know, a week after the storm, that church is now closing. That served as a right. major hub point. As of today, this is the last day people could donate in that church. On Friday, they will be closed and out of there, and they've been a major distribution hub. So, you know, just to shouting out to listeners as we come down to, you know, the last 5-10 minutes of the show here, please go if you're concerned and want to help to InterOccupy, that's I-N-T-E-R Occupy, OCCUPY.net, and there you can go /Occupy Sandy, /, and you can look at all of the efforts, look at what's needed. You can mail stuff, you can ship stuff, you can donate. Sadly, this main hub in Brooklyn is closing, and this just shows and highlights, you know, what you're saying, Jessica, which mm-hmm. is, you know, we, you know, if the major city, which is allocated to do this, isn't doing it, and volunteers have to do it in volunteer spaces donated by churches, I think the effort has been, as you're describing, one of the most courageous, valiant, caring step-ups by ordinary citizens who care. And I'm asking listeners to this show, please distribute this show to others who may not be aware of what's going on. You can, you know, to let them know. But I'm asking listeners to match that effort of caring by supporting these people, both through putting pressure on politicians, through donating, you know, through raising awareness and disseminating on social media, whatever you can do, because this is just, you know, a tragedy. And also, I have to say, you know, we've seen it happening elsewhere, but if, you know, if if we don't act in a concerted way to prevent these things, and we think, oh, it'll never happen again, and we allow it to happen in a major environment like New York, that should, you know, I know a lot of people say, oh, New York, I could never live there, this or that. But the thing is, if it's allowed to happen in New York, where there is, where the media has a national presence, where there is so many, such a high population, if it can happen in New York, it can happen wherever you happen to be that are listening to this show. And if, you know, this degree of neglect can happen, then we really shouldn't be taking for granted, you know, that there won't be further neglect as the climate situation continues to deteriorate for us. And so, you know, I also, you know, urge people to get active on that front, too. Like, this is the triage front, which shows us what can happen, and it can get worse from here, actually, depending on what the weather does and where it hits. Go ahead. Yeah,
and along those lines, I was going to say, I mean, I have a couple of things. First is another, we still really need volunteers, especially volunteers who can give more than a day of their time, because some of these projects require a little bit extra time, and that would be super helpful. One of the organizations, one of our partner organizations that I mentioned, You Are Never Alone, YANA, there's a fundraising site for that organization. We're trying to rebuild it. It's, like I said, it's supposed to be a career training facility, but Sal is also really committed to it being rebuilt green and teaching jobs in renewables. And so you can go to bit.ly/restoreYANA, YANA. And we, like I said, we're trying to get as much education on the ground about all of this as we're rebuilding. I mean, the idea is to rebuild out here, you know, according to what the communities need and want. But what the communities need and want is jobs that are going to be sustainable, jobs that are going to stay local, and jobs that are going to make the Rockaway is a healthier, safer place. Everybody's conscious out here now of what's going on. We're talking about the Rockaway pipeline that they snuck literally under the cover of darkness while there was no electricity in half of the Rockaway, so people don't even know that it's happening. They're going to stick it under the crumbling infrastructure out here, where what we could be doing is building offshore wind turbines, and we could lower the rates of the wind that's going to come down to the shorefront in the event of other storms. I mean, there's so much to be done on the community level, and the community organizations are really engaged in this, and that's part of what YANA wants to be a part of, and we're trying to build out places like YANA, and then like friends, you know, other friends that we've worked with out here to rebuild their places as pilot projects to show how renewable energy can be used to rebuild this in order to both obviously lessen our impact on climate change, but also to make sure that these places are built in a resilient manner for the time that this next storm happens. If all of these places out here were running on solar power, first of all, we wouldn't have all these generators. Second of all, we wouldn't have had the saltwater inundation of the boilers and all these other things. I mean, there's so many ways that this storm would have been so much less impactful on the people on the ground here had we been running on renewable energy. Had there been wind turbines out there that cut the wind speeds by 30 miles an hour, then the storm surge would have been less. The power would have been banking for while it was off, and we would have had batteries charging, and we would have been able to get back online out here, you know, and we wouldn't be running generators, and we wouldn't be, you know, siphoning fossil fuels around because we didn't have anywhere to go, and no one could get to the gas, which was also cut off by the electric. I mean, this is the time to build a smart grid.
Your enthusiasm is great, but I also want to make sure people are digesting what you're saying.
Yep.
So you're, because we are down to our last 3 minutes here. So just briefly, I just want to summarize because we're kind of going to have to do the show wrap-up. But you're saying that with wind turbines, it would actually not only harvest energy so that this, you know, the region would not go out and be that vulnerable. It would not only save fossil fuel use, but it would also actually take up some of the wind to actually lessen the impact of the storm. That is quite an amazing trifecta. So, you know, I think we'll kind of come down and close the show with this kind of thought going on here, because, in other words, it's not just this is a horrible tragedy, there are no solutions, I can't face it. There actually are incredibly creative solutions coming out of this. If we go for those solutions as they emerge from the people who really care, groups like you, Occupy Sandy, YANA, as you've mentioned, I hope our listeners will go and contribute and support, and also
also follow what they're doing, and I'll be covering this.
Can I interrupt real quick to say, and also from the community groups here, I mean, that's the key point, is this is what the community here wants. Like, we are the conduit to outside resources, but this isn't us coming in and saying this is the answer. It's talking to community members and community groups here that want this to be their future.
So it's out of this, instead of just wiping out their community and treating them like as disposable, so that someone somewhere else can, you know, harvest some big financial return. This is really honoring and using this as an opportunity for rebuilding, regrowth, and recommitment to the people who have suffered, rather than, you know, going on to make them and others. Because, you know, it hit here this time. Some of these places are more environmental. Mentally vulnerable due to location, but as waters keep rising, other places can be affected, and storms can go in different directions. So this is really both to dignify the loss rather than just to use it as a profit center, and it also is to prepare others, prepare ourselves, really all of us, you know, for hard environmental times, of which this is a harbinger. So I want to thank you so much, Jessica Roth, for taking the time out, and I hope you got a warm cup of tea before you head out again and take some slippery elm and vitamin C and all of that, you know, to stay healthy throughout this. And thank you to you, and convey our thanks as well to all the people who are volunteering and to the Valiant communities. We'll hopefully have you back on another time to report, and maybe have more positive reports as things proceed. And so, you know, please do contribute, listeners, and you can tune in next week to Connect the Dots. I'm going to have a very interesting show next week also on these continuing themes. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network to connect the dots between your health and your total health environment. Thanks for being with us. We'll